We are. You asked me a question about child custody. That was a question that came up yesterday about how the mission thinks about child custody. I couldn't find a direct answer to that question in the sense of a situation where, like, the husband divorces the wife, and then the Misha talks about what happened to the kids. There's no precise analog. I mix up the word analog and parallel, but there is a situation which might answer the question, which is just based on what it assumes. So this is the case of someone hanoseya taisha, a man marries a woman, upaska imo, and she makes a deal with him, like in the ketubah. That he should support her daughter for 5 years, so presumably a daughter from a previous marriage. Then he's liable to do that. His love is actually carry that through because he agreed to it in the ketubah. So it's the assumption of this Mishnah is that the daughter is with the wife. And therefore, it sounds like child custody might default to the mother. I'm not sure they have like child custody per se, but it's possible that they might default to the mother based on this Mishnah, just because based on what it assumes. It seems to think the daughter hanging out with the unmarried mother is a likely scenario. So this would only be a minor daughter though, a major daughter who was not married. That's the only case where this would come up. If it was a married daughter, then you'd assume the husband would look after them, which comes up later on in this chapter of Ketubot. Similarly, if it was like a major son, you would assume that the son would be able to make a living themselves. They don't have an exact cutoff for major and minor for bat mitzvah. They don't have the idea of bat mitzvah. A bar mitzvah, the concept of a bar mitzvah is about 1,000 years old or less. The concept of a bat mitzvah is significantly younger than that, maybe 100 or 200 years ago. So they have definitions for what considers being an adult or not, which mostly involves signs of puberty. But it does often happen around the ages of a bar or a bat mitzvah. Men might not want to be burdened with a marriage dowry for a daughter. Yes, certainly, right. This paskaim, the whole point is that this is not a default situation where the husband would, of course, look after all the children from a previous marriage. That's not at all clear that would be the default case. So this is the whole point of cutting the deal is that. The time of the Mishnah, when did the son become a responsible adult? So yeah, it's not totally clear. Responsible adult is also different from like technically an adult. Technically an adult, it's after a certain amount of pubic hair has appeared. That's technically an adult. Responsible adult might be a bit different claim. I also think that, what was I going to say about that? Oh yeah, the Mishnah also has this different idea about responsible for mitzvot, so I can talk about that. So the Mishnah doesn't deal with this, but the Tosefta does. There's a Tosefta in Sukkah somewhere, which I am able to find in the time, basically talks about training your children for mitzvot, and the basic principle there is when a child is old enough to do a particular mitzvah, you train them in that mitzvah. There's no sense of like, now that here's a 30, once you're 13, there's a cutoff, and that's the end. Now you're responsible for all mitzvot, and before you're responsible for none. That's not how the Mishnah thinks about it. They think about it as gradually, like as soon as you're able to wear a tzitzit and you're not gonna like soil them, you should wear a tzitzit. As soon as you're able to blow the shofar, you should blow the shofar, etc. Like it's a very much of a training mindset. So I don't think they had not like your 18th birthday, you become an adult. I don't think they have that exact same idea about what's going on. They also have different ideas about childhood in general. The notion of childhood is fairly modern. Like children are different beings than us rather than just mini adults. That's actually a pretty recent phenomenon. It's hard. It's hard to put all this together because what they mean by children is sometimes different from what we mean by children. So we did the first three Mishnah yesterday. We talked about how what seems to be a fairly non-legal process in the Torah, which is explicitly excluded the possibility of witnesses, becomes a much more formal process in the Mishnah, that there actually becomes two stages. There's a stage of warning and a stage of, seclusion. So what's normally called. So the stage of warning requires two witnesses according to everyone. You have to like, the husband has to say, you can't anymore go see this particular man. And then if she does that in front of two witnesses, and then if she does that anyway, then people argue about how many witnesses you need to have seen her go into the room with this guy. We also talked about how as soon as she becomes a sotah, the marriage is a bit suspended. I just wanted to highlight that it's definitely not undone, because of this last line of the Mishnah here, Mishnah 2. If, in fact, the marriage was totally severed, there would be no point to do chalitza, to do the severing of the levirate bond. And the severing of the levirate bond is a way of... The fact that you need to sever that bond shows you that the marriage is still in effect, even though the main aspects of it has been suspended, which are expressed in they're forbidden to each other, they're forbidden to have sex, and also if her husband is a priest, she is forbidden to eat truma from that moment on, from the moment she became declared a sota. In other words, she went through the two stages of warning and seclusion, and then she becomes a sota. So they're immediately forbidden to each other. And then we also saw this situation. We learned that the sota ritual requires consent from both parties, because if she says, "Eini shota," I don't want to drink it, or if he doesn't want to make her drink it, then she's just forbidden to him. There's no way out, that you don't do the sota ritual. The whole point of the sota ritual is there's the way out of this forbidden limbo you're in. You can get out of it by completing the sota ritual and showing that she's innocent. But if you don't want to do the sota ritual, then there's no way out. You're just stuck in this this suspended marriage. Though you can, then the court will make you get divorced, as we'll see in a later Mishnah. But so it requires the consent of both parties. It also would never happen if the wife admits to having sex with another man. If she says, "I'll merit mea anilach," then that's it. She's admitted to it. There's no point doing the sota ritual. The whole point of doing a sota ritual is you're not sure. If you're basically sure, then the sota ritual is kind of over. So you just have to end the marriage. And then we talked about how it also becomes more of a court situation, that in the Torah, the discussion is about bringing both parties before the priest. And the priest like does all the sacrifice stuff and makes the waters and picks up the dirt from the floor of the Mishkan. Here again, it becomes more court situated. So the husband takes her to actual court. The court makes sure that this is actually has fulfilled the requirements for sota, and then they give, according to the majority opinion, they give them an accompaniment, the couple an accompaniment of two disciples to take her to Jerusalem, which is where they have to do the court case. Because it's a potentially capital case, and capital cases have to be done with courts of 23 or 71, 70 or 71. And this court of 71 is in Jerusalem. And because of the, or I think also because of taking to the priest and the rhetoric about the Mishkan in the Torah, it's clear that this is a temple ceremony, has to happen in the temple in Jerusalem. So according to majority opinion, they would have an escort to get to Jerusalem. And according to Rabbi Huda, there's no need for an escort. And as we're going to find out in a second, it seems like also her family went with. So her family also went to make sure about the judgment, make sure that everything was good, and to see her be innocent, hopefully. Now, we're going to continue along with that narrative, and we're going to talk about what happened when they arrived into Yerushalayim, into the Great Court. Hayuma Elinota, Levet Din HaGadol Sheb Yerushalayim. They, presumably the two Talmidei Chachamim, bring her to the court, the Great Court in Jerusalem, which is sometimes called the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin is a bit of an elusive body. It seems like it didn't meet all the time. A Sanhedrin had to be convened in order to meet. So you'd have to say, "I need the Sanhedrin. Okay, let's find 70, 71 people to put it all together." So it seems like you would have to convene a special court for this sort of happening. Umayamin aleha chaderech shemayamin al yad al eidei nefashot. They scare her. They sort of make her afraid in the way that they also make afraid the witnesses for capital cases. There's a Mishnah in Sanhedrin that talks about exactly the same phrase. How do they make afraid the witnesses for capital cases? They bring them in, they intimidate them, they make sure they didn't hear it by a rumor, or they didn't just like make an assumption. They actually heard it from the person, from people. They saw the actual acts happen. They didn't hear it secondhand in any way. And they do also this thing which is called Drisha V'Chakira. They examine them and make sure their testimony matches up and all those kind of things. And then they also have this whole thing about don't you know that human life is very important? You know, with monetary cases, you can just give money and then you're done. But dina nafashot, with capital cases, their entire descendants are based on this action. Like you're potentially killing an unlimited number of people if you testify incorrectly. So it goes on at great length about the value of human life. And that's the same kind of thing they would do here, which is just say that, like, yeah, this is a really serious thing. Somebody could lose their life. This matters. So they would firstly intimidate her in order to try and get her to confess, in order to try to avoid having to go through the Sotah ritual for a bunch of reasons, as you'll see. Firstly, the Sotah ritual is certainly no fun for anyone involved. And secondly, because they want to avoid the name of God being destroyed for no reason. Given that they're about to crush the name of God in the water, they don't want to do that if there's no reason to do it. So they would rather avoid the entire thing. So this the court's main job is to try to get her to confess her sin, and then the marriage can just be over and we can be done with it, and we don't have to go through this horrendous ritual, and we don't have to destroy the name of God for no reason. So they intimidate her, and they say also things like this. V'omrimla, they say to her, Biti, harbe yayin ose, harbe schok ose, harbe yaldut osa, harbe shchinim haraim osim. My daughter, wine does much, you know, frivolity does much, childness does much, childishness, bad neighbors do much. These are all like potential reasons for why she could have gone astray. Maybe she was drunk, maybe she was she's engages in too much frivolity, she's too childish, or she had bad neighbors steered her on the wrong path. So these are all like, it's not a big deal. Like, just confess. You know, there's lots of reasons why one might do this. It's not a big deal if you just confess it now, and then we can be done with all of this. Like, just be, get it out there, get it over with, so we don't have to go through all of this terrible stuff. Just confess, do it, because of God's great name, which is written in holiness, so that it shouldn't be erased in the water. Just do it now, so we don't have to even do the God's name thing. Just confess. The very strong emphasis on confession. The Mishnah also, with in the capital cases scenario, also focuses very much on confession. Later on, where they're talking about the condemned coming out to be stoned, everyone encourages them to confess. Is adultery always a capital offense? Yes, adultery is always a capital offense. The key point about the Sotah is that it's not adultery. There's no proof that it was adultery. That's the whole thing. In order for it to be adultery, in order to be tried as an actual adultery case, in order to be a capital case, then you would have to have two witnesses who saw the act and warned them about it. So it can't be. If she confesses at any point, she will not be put to death. She will... the marriage will end, she'll have to leave without her ketubah, but that's it. That's the only punishment. I would think it would be more a problem for the man than a woman. Which would be more a problem? If you just clarify that, Judith, and I'll answer your question. Okay. Great. So again, there's very strong emphasis on confession. With the condemned, the instance about confession, the insistence about confession is that they should be atoned for as well. That, like, confession gives you atonement. So that might be also one of the motivating factors here. It's like, if you just confess it, you'll be more atoned for. I would think there'd be more problem for the man than the woman, but for some reason, it's never an issue for men. I meant that more men commit adultery than women, but only women are blamed. Yes. So this is obviously a big problem. This is related to the kind of larger Mediterranean society of sort of honor and shame, that, like, women are the people attached to the community, to your family unit, who are like the weak links. Like, they have the possibility to dishonor your family, etc. So, Sarah, it actually is adultery if men have sex outside of marriage. The thing is about the Torah is it's actually contradictory. Earlier on, I think if you actually, this is a couple week ago, 2 weeks ago, in Parashat Kedoshim, Achrimot Kedoshim, when we did that, so it was in Achrimot. There's two passages about sexual sins. The first passage implies no punishment. The second passage certainly shows that the man and the woman will be put to death. But there are other places in the Torah where only the woman is put to death. But like the overwhelming sense of the rabbinic law as it comes out via the Torah is that men and women can do adultery. They both will be put to death for such a thing. That's exactly the point. The Torah is fighting a war against what is known in the culture, which is that women are punished for adultery and men are not. There are parts of the Torah which fight a cultural war against that and say, no, adultery is just as big a problem for the man as for the woman. You'll find, as I said, conflicting voices about this in the Torah. But the way it falls out is that adultery happens to both. That's also true, yes. Judah wasn't married when he had sex with Tamar. That's also true. All that is, this is all related to like the honor and shame stuff of Mediterranean society. Very uncomfortable and sometimes difficult for us to understand. And that's part of the Sotah thing here. But what I think is interesting about this is the way in which they want anything to happen except for the Sotah ceremony. Like the way this is laid out is to make it so hard to convict someone to be a Sotah and then to just make her confess in order that this doesn't have to be taken through. Zimri and Cosby is a different situation, Fred, because it's sex with a foreign person. No adultery, but yes, they are both killed for sure. So then the last thing the Mishnah says is actually kind of amazing, which is it says here, V'omrim lefaneha dvarim she'ina kedai l'shom'an, v'hi v'chol mishpachat beit aviha. They would say to her things which are not even appropriate to be heard. So they would now continue on and say other things, but the Mishnah refuses to tell us what it was. It would say things that were inappropriate to be passed down in the setting of a shiur like this. That's it. Her and her whole family. Her whole family shouldn't hear this either, even though they were probably there when this happened. They were in the court. That's what seems to suggest that her family came along with. Is this line? It seems like they were there, right there in the court with her when this was all happening. So we don't know what else they said because the Mishnah refuses to tell us. The Gemara says that they relate to her the... Because the Gemara can't leave a question unanswered. It's totally impossible for them. Given a phrase like this, they have to tell you what they actually said, even though the whole point of the Mishnah is that they don't want to tell you what they said. That what they said is they told about the biblical narratives of adultery and how it all worked out correctly. It's like Judah and Tamar, and just like to try and convince her to confess. They give some of those narratives. There's no reason why that would be, by the way, not appropriate to be heard. For sure it's appropriate to be heard. They would read it in shul. Like, it's totally fine to... Though it doesn't make sense as a reading of the Mishnah, but it is what the Gemara says. Okay. So now we're going to get back to the situation of when she's not a Sotah. We're just going to deal with that in one throwaway line. This is something that the Mishnah does fairly often, which is a result of its orality, is that this is actually continuing on a conversation, well, in part continuing on a conversation based that came up in Mishnah 3, which is the one who says, Tumea Ani. And then we had this... this sort of aside as we're going telling the story. And here's another situation where she might confess about it. But actually this just as much applies to Mishnah 3 as it does now. Imra Tmeya Ani, if she said, yeah, you're right, I am impure, I did it, I confess. Shoveret ketubata v'yotzeit. She gets a receipt for the ketubah and she leaves. The receipt for the ketubah is to show that she has received her ketubah. So she doesn't actually get her ketubah, she just gets the receipt for it. In other words, she can no longer collect it. If they didn't give her a receipt, she could come back in like 10 years or something in a different court that nobody saw this happen and say, hey, look, I didn't get a receipt for my ketubah, this guy owes me money. So she has to have the receipt in order for that not to be able to happen. The point is that she gets the receipt to prove that she lost the ketubah. Yeah, so she goes out without the ketubah. This is, by the way, I talked about this last time about how the Mishnah is not at all squeamish about forcing divorces on people. Here's just a clear example. It's like, yeah, they have to be divorced. That's it. Like, yeah, obviously. No squeamishness whatsoever. Less patience with those arguments today when the Mishnah so clearly doesn't care about that at all. She gets no money if she has no ketubah. That's exactly right. So yeah, she admitted to it. No marital counseling. Yes. Well, we didn't know the marital counseling. I think, as I said before, once you're already getting to the warning stage, you really needed marital counseling well before that. Like, so they should have done that earlier. Okay. But so now, if she's going through all of this and then she agrees to confess, end of the case, there's no sota, she goes out without her ketubah. Again, if witnesses could prove that she actually had sex with this man, actually committed adultery, then she would be put to death. But that's not the case here. There's no way to prove it one way or the other. Ve'im amra tahora ani, but if she continues to say I'm pure, if she continues to protest her innocence, Ma'alinota l'shar ha'mizrach sh'al petach sh'ar nikanor, she'sham mashkin et hasotot, matarin et hayoldot, matarin et hamitzorayim. So this, they would take her to where the ceremony takes place, which is the eastern gate, just above the gate of Nicanor, or at the gate of Nicanor. I talked about this gate the other a few times. It's a great gate. But yeah, there are two eastern entrances to the temple. One of them is called the Gate of Nicanor, and there they would cause the sotot to drink the water, and they would purify the women who had just given birth. A few weeks ago in the Torah portion, it talks about the period of impurity a woman goes through after giving birth and then brings a sacrifice after a certain number of days, then she becomes pure again. And also Matarin et Hamitzorayim, they would also there do the purity for the for the people struck with tzara'at. So those people also would... The point of doing this outside the temple, this is slightly outside the main court, is because they're currently impure. So they can't enter the temple court. So you want to do it outside the gate, so then they're not in the temple precincts per se, and then they can come in, and that's totally fine. And then by association, the sotot are also done there, even though they're not technically impure. There's a whole rhetoric of purity and impurity where it comes to adultery here, associates her moral impurity of perhaps committing adultery with like the actual ritual impurity of the women who gave birth and the people who were struck with tzara'at. How many gates are named? Yeah, I don't know. The place to look for the Mishnah's discussion of the temple is Midot, Masechet Midot. It's basically just a description of the second temple. So that's where it happens. It happens in a public area outside the temple in order not to go inside the temple and sort of metaphorically defile it. With the Yoldot and the Mitzorim, it's literally defiling the temple. Here it's sort of a metaphorical defiling of the temple. The Kohen Ochez Bivgadeha. The Kohen, the priest there, now it gets into the description of the ceremony, the priest there seizes her clothes. Im Nikra'u Nikra'u V'im Nifra'u Niframu. If the clothes start to tear, that's it. They tear. Nothing you can do about it. If the clothes start to come apart at the seams, they come apart at the seams. That's just the way it is. Ad shehu magale et liba, until he reveals her chest. V'soter et sa'ara, he undoes her hair. Soter is to either to undo it or to dishevel it, to make it sort of to undo any nice thing in the hair. This is this is like part of the horrifying part of the ceremony and we'll come back to this. Yeah, a little bit she tears her clothes and exposes her breast, though you'll see the point is not to go too far in a couple of different ways, but yeah, you go a little bit far, and part of that is a deterrent, like you want to basically deter anyone else from doing this ceremony, number one, and number two, from doing any of these acts, from doing adultery. And there's also a scriptural hook for this kind of treatment that we'll get to in the next Mishnah, which they also talk about. Rabbi Hud Omer, Rabbi Hud has a concern about this procedure. Im haya liba na'e, lo haya magalehu. Im haya sara na'e, lo haya sotro. Rabbi Hud is worried that the point of this ceremony is to make people, make this woman sort of defiled in other people's eyes, is to make her dishonored. And so that other people will not want to ever go close to going through what she's going through. But what he's worried about is that this kind of like tearing of the clothes is a kind of titillation for the people watching. And that might have the opposite effect. It might have like encourage people to go and have sex with people who aren't their partners. So he has a little, just a thing on that, which is just to say, you don't always do it. You don't do it if she's beautiful, essentially is what it says here. So if you're worried that it will like actually cause sexual arousal, that's not what you are trying to do. You're trying to do that other way. So one-sided, this is incredibly difficult, abusive to a woman who's merely accused, shameful. Right, good. 100%. it is incredibly one-sided and it is abusive. The only silver lining I can say here is that the chances, just imagine this scenario. The marriage has gone through something terrible, so much so that the man has to get two of his friends to warn her in front of his two friends, to warn her about seeing a particular man. And then he has to find other witnesses to, or has to see it himself to prove that she went into seclusion with that man. Like, that's actually quite a lot. That's actually quite a high bar to pass through. What the missionary is trying to do, and you can argue whether they're successful or not, maybe they're not successful, that they're trying to raise the bar. But the judges will also intimidate the witnesses. You can always find buddies who will lie on his behalf. The judges will intimidate the witnesses and make sure that their testimony makes sense. That will happen in his town. We didn't talk about that specifically, but for sure that will happen in the town. They trust witness testimony. It's the most reliable way they have of getting information. Obviously, people can lie, but they have the most reliable way of getting information. Also, if they were found to be lying witnesses, they would be put to death because they tried to get her to be put to death. I'm not trying to defend this, actually. It's it's uncomfortable for me to read. It's uncomfortable for me to teach. Could be part of the point here. But I just wanted to say that, I don't think either the husband or the wife would be incentivized to go through this procedure. I think that neither party would ever want this. We saw this a couple of ways where that actually entertained the situation of the husband doesn't want to do it. Like, the husband warned her and then is like, you know what, I'm actually out. Yeah, exactly. That's the point. Exactly. Do all this simply to avoid returning the ketubah. Exactly. It just seems a little bit much. May as well just pay the ketubah at that point. Okay. So thank you, everybody. See you back tomorrow for some slightly better material.